Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Preparations are underway in and around Springfield, Illinois, to commemorate the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's burial in the Illinois Capitol. Events are planned for this weekend to mark the anniversary and will include a reenactment featuring military burial ceremonies, a detailed replica of the hearse in which the late president's body was carried, and the coffin in which Mr. Lincoln was interred. Much attention has been given to the historical accuracy of all elements of the reenactment. We'll be talking about all of it on today's program. Joining me in studio is Ian Hunt, historian at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum Foundation. With us by phone is Katie Spindell, chairperson of the 2015 Lincoln Funeral Coalition. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Tim Tomlinson, who chairs the Great Rivers Lincoln Coffin Project and president of the Historic ELSA Foundation. P.J. Staub, president and co-owner of the Staub Funeral Home, will also join us in a few minutes, as will Larry Werlein, a reenactor. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Ian, good to see you. And Katie, thank you so much for being with us.
You are quite welcome. Thank you for having all of us.
Ian, let me start with you. Give us a sense of what the general mood of the country was at this particular time. We've just had the assassination of the president. The Civil War has just ended. What kind of shape was the country in?
I think that most of the nation was very scared with the death of the president. There was a fear that everything that the country had sacrificed over 4 years of fighting would suddenly be for naught, that the government might spin out of control, that calamity would befall us. So there was a lot of fear. There was quite a lot of anger in the North that this was a Southern conspiracy to try to overturn the Northern government. And a great deal of sadness. Mr. Lincoln was a very popular man. He was very much beloved here in Springfield, and I think they were overwhelmed with that.
And there was yet a wonderful turnout along the route of the funeral cortege, if you will, the train ride from Washington, D.C. to this part of the country.
Absolutely. Each of the 12 cities that the train stopped at where the president's body was placed on display received huge turnouts. There were also massive crowds that would gather at the train tracks simply to pay homage to the president's train as it passed by. We actually estimate that somewhere in the neighborhood of as many as 7 million people physically left their homes so that they could either be at one of the public displays of the president's body or so that they could witness the train as it went by.
We've been told by one of the reenactors that actually there were several funeral ceremonies because at every stop, every juncture along the way, that's in effect what was happening.
Correct.
Right. All right. Katie Spindell, let me bring you into this. You are charged with putting all of this together for this weekend. How are you going to capture all of what we've just been hearing about this weekend?
Well, the first issue that we have is there really is no great emotion as it was in 1865 connected to this. So we have created the closest thing that we can to a solemn and historic event. The reenactors all know how to do this. The clergy know how to do this. And it will be as close as we can possibly get to the actual funeral.
How do you know? How do you know how close you're going to be?
Well, we have the benefit of the funeral in 1865 was written about a great deal in many newspapers and in books. So we've all had researchers looking at every aspect of this so that we knew what we needed to do. And an example of that is out at Oak Ridge, we were able to find the order of service, the names of the clergy, and when they performed in that. And they also, we know most, not all, of the actual prayers and the second inaugural that was done. Reverend Dr. Matthew Simpson in 1865 had what he was considered the orator of the day, and that is recorded so that we have that. And so we're able to recreate Oak Ridge as it was in 1865.
Ian Hunt, this is a historian's dream, is it not, to have all access to all this information?
It's a dream, and it's also a bit of a nightmare, trying to make sure that all of the details are correct. Katie is absolutely right. There were many, many accounts written about officially. There were reports, governmental reports offered on this event. There were newspaper accounts. There are private letters from individuals who witnessed it. who talk about things. And not always do they all agree on everything. So it's trying to flush together what is the most accurate portrayal of this.
I wonder if there had ever been anything quite like this before.
Not to this magnitude. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Ian.
I would say not to this magnitude, no. Not only there had certainly been presidents who had died in office prior to Mr. Lincoln, but there had never been a president assassinated, and never under the circumstances that the presidential assassination went through.
Katie, you wanted to add something. Go ahead, please.
Well, I agree with Ian. We know that with the Civil War having begun to conclude, that the nation was in turmoil. They had lost many soldiers on both sides. And then to have the president assassinated was pretty much the last check mark on all of this. And it was devastating to this nation. And we have Jack Kennedy as an example. And yes, we had all the filming of that. But what we didn't have was it had just been another war. We had just finished the largest war in our nation's history on our soil.
Many people are, of course, familiar with the Kennedy funeral, whether they were alive at the time or whether they've seen a film and video of it since. I wonder if in any way the Kennedy funeral was similar to what went on in the Lincoln funeral ceremony. Katie, do you have any idea?
Jacqueline Kennedy did try to pattern the president's funeral after Lincoln's. And so we do know that. Now, I've not done any studying on Kennedy's assassination, and yes, I was alive then. But I do know that her intent was to pattern his funeral after Lincoln's, and so that there were aspects of that. Part of that was brought in as the riderless horse, and in 1865, even though it wasn't considered the riderless horse, old Bob, President Lincoln's horse, was also in the procession in 1865 without a rider. He was just brought along by Reverend Henry Brown.
Well, there's evidence of the kind of detail that we're talking about. If you know the name of Lincoln's horse as a result of what records are available. Ian Hunt, you wanted to add something with regard to comparing the two funerals?
What we know today as far as state funerals, what we typically see the military caisson carrying the casket, the caparisoned horse, the riderless horse. Those evolved out of mostly Civil War era ceremonies. In fact, the artillery caissons would be going to the front carrying ammunition for the artillery batteries, and then they would load up wounded and dead soldiers and return them back to field hospitals. So a lot of what was seen in 1865, a lot of what took place, were the ceremonies that had been going on during the 4 years of fighting, and those have carried through into the modern era. This is what we traditionally see in presidential funerals today.
It's really hard to grasp the depth of the emotion that we've talked about earlier with regard to what was going on in the country, to have that all happen at once as it did.
I would say that as far as a physical shock, the closest approximation in my own lifetime would have been the 9/11 tragedies, as far as how it impacted the nation and how everything just seemed to stop when that event occurred. And that's the best I can offer.
Yeah, you know, I would think that if we had the 9/11 tragedy and then 2 weeks later had another similar kind of tragedy, that would more closely approximate what went on.
Probably.
Katie, back to you with regard to pulling all this together. I mean, I know you're a very busy lady right now, but you have been for a long time. How do you get all this together and make it happen in one place at one time?
I think the most important part, and I have been doing this for 6 years, this planning has been going on that long, but the most important part, as far as I'm personally concerned, is that I don't do this from ego. I don't know anything about Civil War reenactors. So what I did was, after I built this corporation, I went out and I found the individuals who were much more knowledgeable than I on any of the aspects that were required. And I set them to the task, and they have done it beautifully. An example of that is that we simply had to add a few things to that particular procession, and one of them was a fire pumper, an antique fire pumper. Well, where do you go for a fire pumper? You go to the fire department. And they have brought in fact, it arrived last Saturday, and it's absolutely breathtaking, an antique fire pumper from the Belle Plaine, Iowa Fire Department. They drove it down here. It will be part of the procession. Another example of that is horses. What you need with horses, you've got live animals. You need to make sure that they're taken care of. And you need to know what you have to have. And I was blessed to have Dr. Carl Luthen come forth. And Carl is the man who provided all the horses and the carriages and the tack for Steven Spielberg's movie Lincoln. And he is doing the same thing for us. So not only do I have someone that has the expertise with that, but Dr. Luthen is a licensed veterinarian. So that means that the horses will be well cared for, and I don't have to worry about that aspect. So that's how I went about this. I did not do this from my own ego saying I know everything, because I don't. And I have gotten a lot of people surrounding this event who are absolutely extraordinary. Ian Hunt is one of them. P.J. Staub. P.J. Staub, when you talk to him, you are talking to someone extraordinary. When we have the coffin, every one of these individuals, every one of these groups knows what they're doing, and they've done it very, very well.
What about the funding for all of this? It's my impression that some money had been appropriated or was to be appropriated for this project, and then suddenly it wasn't there. What's that story?
That's correct. We had a $75,000 grant with the state of Illinois, and we were informed that we had been awarded that grant. And then after the inauguration for our new governor, that grant was removed when he said that he would freeze all discretionary spending. So that has put this into an extremely difficult situation. And what I did was I required everybody to pull back on what they were doing. In other words, and I just had an example. This morning I got the last quote for walkie-talkies, and you have to have things like this. It started out at $6,000. It's now $2,500. We've had people that have been so kind, people like Buckley's Landscaping, Fifth Street Flower, they have donated the flowers for this event. We have, fortunately, a little over $300,000 in in-kind support alone. This event cost about $520,000. And then we have consistently, especially after the grant was lost, pulled this back so that we can fit within this. We are a 501c3, so we're certainly not looking to make money. And I think one of the important things is that no one, including me, has been paid to do this. No lunches are being paid. No gas is being paid. No toner for your cartridges, your printers are being paid. Every donation goes straight to the event, which was one of my mandates. And so, with that said, if anyone is willing to donate, we certainly could use the help. This is very, very difficult. Will we make it? Yes. Will it be everything we wanted it to be? Oh, it'll be close. It will be very, very close.
What did you have to give up?
We were going to have a canopy over the stage, and I think we're going to be giving that up. We've had to do a number of things that were given up. Now, the integrity of the event, the procession, the ceremonies, and that will all be the same. But we've had to give up extra things. We may not be able to get the mast over the street removed, which, by the way, is a traffic light, so that pictures from the national press aren't showing a wonderful ceremony, a hearse, and, oh, by the way, red, yellow, and green traffic light. And that's $4,000. We may not be able to do that. So it isn't that the procession will be different. It will be the little support things around it that were there to make it better.
Just a slight anachronism with the traffic lights, but I think people can get over that, I hope.
Well, the national press are rather fussy about things like that. and they want this to be, they want to be able to get a picture of the hearse without a traffic light. They want to be able to get a picture of the opening ceremony stage with the dignitaries without a traffic light. Is it a crisis? No. So that is one of the ideas that, I said, well, if we can't do it, we can't do it.
Our time is winding down, Katie, but in terms of crowds, what sort of numbers are you looking for this weekend? Do you have any idea?
There's no way to know. There's no precedence for this. It's never been done before except in 1865. But I'm going to say that we are expecting probably tens of thousands. And I can tell you this. If someone will call me on May 4th, I'll be able to tell you how many we had. But in the meantime, I have to guess as well as everyone else, including emergency management, saying every day, how many are going to be here, Katie?
Yeah. You'll be able to tell on the 4th if you're awake on the 4th, Katie. It sounds like you might sleep in on the 4th of May.
I just might.
Yeah.
I just might.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations to you on all the hard work you've put in. And I'm sure it's going to be a wonderful weekend for you, the people of Springfield, and the people of this country. Thank you, Katie.
Well, I hope that the Springfield people know how fortunate they are to have so many wonderful people in the town doing so many extraordinary things.
I'm betting they do. Katie Spindell, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, the Recreators. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation about events commemorating the burial of Abraham Lincoln 150 years ago. In studio with me is Ian Hunt, historian at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum Foundation. Joining us in studio is Tim Tomlinson. He chairs the Great Rivers Lincoln Coffin Project and is president of the historic ELSA Foundation. Joining us by phone is P.J. Staub, president and co-owner of Staub Funeral Home in Springfield. Thank you all so much for joining us. Tim, good to have you. P.J., thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I just have one quick question for Ian before we move on to some of the things that have been recreated for this event. When we talked to Katie a moment ago, she said she didn't have any idea how many people were present for the funeral ceremonies in Springfield. Do you, by any chance, as a historian, do you have any numbers?
For the original?
Yeah.
It was estimated that 150,000 people descended on the community of Springfield. Which is pretty remarkable. There were only about 15,000 residents at that time.
Yeah, that is remarkable, again, particularly given the kinds of things that were going on. Okay, now let's talk about some of the replicas that are being brought into play. Tim, I'll start with you. Yours is the Coffin Project, I'll call it. Tell us about it. What exactly is involved here?
Well, the Coffin Project came about because of a visit by Katie Spindell to our Chautauqua community on the Great Rivers Road some 20 months ago. At a lecture, she indicated that there were things needed still for the reenactment and wondered if there might be volunteers to create some of the to deal with some of the needs. My wife, Rose, and a friend from Grafton, Mary Lilsby, asked her specifically, well, what do you need? And her answer was, we need a coffin. So that's how our involvement came about. We decided that, well, we can do that, and off the project began.
Well, some people might think that a coffin is a coffin is a coffin. What was special about this particular coffin?
Well, our first reaction was a coffin is a coffin is a coffin. Yeah. And then as we began to look into the activity or the need, we began to see that this was a very elegant, a very, very expensive-looking, very intricate kind of coffin. It was not just a pine box. And as we began to move from that point on, we recognized a lot of the challenges that we faced. For example, what were the dimensions of the coffin? How was the coffin covered? What was the nature of the decorative hardware that that was placed on the coffin? And then how could this group of three local historical societies, some 40 miles outside of St. Louis, take on this task? And
why did they become involved?
Illinois is the land of Lincoln. And many, many people, they don't have to be a historian. When you think of Abraham Lincoln, you think of one of the most widely admired figures in American history, if not the world. And And so we said, this is a life, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This is something that we ought to do.
And P.J. Staub, I'm assuming that your motives are quite similar.
Yes, absolutely. When Katie asked us back in 2013 if we could come up with a suitable funeral hearse that would have looked like Lincoln's in the day, I said, well, I'm sure we can. Well, having said that, we had to recreate, reverse engineer, and actually recreated this from a single photograph, the only known photograph known, and it happened to be of the back and the right-hand side. So we did our best to scale. Once you scale, you get a dimension. Once you dimension it, you look at the scale, and it goes back and forth until you have it visually like that picture. And these veterans who have actually put that together are just in an astounding job giving honor back to the 16th president.
And who are those who put it together?
They range from Blue Ox School for Veterans, and that was one of the originating schools for veterans out in Eureka, California. They needed a project for their local junior college to get on board to start sending them veterans to, in a sense, reclaim their life after the combat fields in Iraq and Afghanistan. And of course, it's owned and operated by Viviana and Eric Hollenbeck, a Vietnam veteran himself. And it started out with Jack Feather down in Tombstone, Arizona. He lived in Bedford at the time in Pennsylvania, which the hearse, we believe, came from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in back in 1857 into St. Louis there at the Lynch and Arnott Stable. And Jay Jones is from Nicholasville, Kentucky, which is about an hour and a half or so from Lincoln's birthplace. And he also happens to be a Vietnam veteran. And so all of a sudden, this thing started taking a life of its own. And it didn't really start out being a veteran's way to reclaim their life, but it sure ended up that way. And we're so proud that we could be a part of that.
I'm going to turn back to Tim now and ask him to describe the coffin. Then I'll ask you to do the same thing, to give us some detail about the hearse. And how close you came to the original. But, Tim, describe the coffin for us.
Well, similar to what PJ has just noted, anyone who's recreating a Lincoln coffin also is going probably back to a single photograph. There was a photograph taken on April 25th in New York City when Lincoln's body was on view at City Hall. And the very existence of that photograph allows people like us to come up and create the coffin. We had a problem, first of all, with dimensions. We know Lincoln's height. We weren't really certain about the width of the body, but the coffin is a six-sided piece of furniture.
Just interrupt for a second. Yeah. Did they build coffins to measure in those days? I don't think we do that anymore. It's a standard size coffin, I always assume.
But my answer would be yes. In large part, coffins were built, particularly a presidential coffin would have built as best one could to measurement. Lincoln's coffin, the coffin we replicated, was built probably within a period of 30 hours because his body was taken away from Peterson House on Saturday morning. The coffin arrived in the White House late Sunday afternoon. So once we'd worked out the dimension problems and we needed to go then to how the rest of the coffin was put together, it was covered with a very fine black wool broadcloth. We went to Brooks Brothers because Brooks Brothers had fashioned, Lincoln's tailor had fashioned a great coat for him, and Brooks Brothers provided us with the great coat itself, so we could use its measurements to come to our dimension as part of our dimensions, and they donated the cloth for the covering. We went to the Batesville Casket Company, who created a similar coffin back in 1984, and we asked them to help us with the decorative hardware, but not to their design, to our design. So we've created something a little bit different than what had already existed, but nonetheless, we're looking at what we have as as having substantial, reasonable documentation.
Was the broadcloth plain? Did it have any kind of decorations of any sort or symbols?
No, none at all. None at all, Don. It was plain black wool broadcloth, and our coffin is completely covered with it. Our coffin is also made out of solid walnut with a second shell interior of poplar. The board provided, donated by a St. Louis firm, Fehlig Brothers Lumber Company, right down here in downtown St. Louis. Everything was donated. The cloth, the wood, the decorative hardware.
How will it be used this weekend? I mean, will it actually be interred?
No, I don't think we'll go that far. It will be placed on a replica funeral train car on Saturday morning. It will be removed ceremoniously from that car, placed in the hearse that PJ has been talking about and has wonderfully created. It will be processed through the streets of Springfield, covered by the flag-draped coffin, to the site of the opening ceremonies. The flag will be removed and ceremoniously folded, and the coffin on a specially constructed catafalque or funeral bier will be visible to anyone, to the tens of thousands that we're talking about, to come by and look. It's a form of Lincoln lying in state through the night and into the next day, and the final procession in the hearse to Oak Ridge Cemetery.
Sounds like it's just going to be a wonderful event to
attend. It's amazingly wonderful.
But PJ, let me turn to you and ask you for the description of that hearse. Knowing the limitations you had in determining exactly what it looked like, describe what you finally came up with.
Well, it was an unfolding of itself from the very beginning of the research that Ian Hunt with you there today, and I helped researched a lot of the newspaper articles of the day, and we found three, Ian found three, that very vividly described it verbally, and it actually is better verbally explained than it would be if you were interpreting what you're seeing in the picture. So when it got down to it, we know that the entire top crowning of this is all 24-karat gold leaf, and it's all metal cast, and as you walk up from that, you'll see 36-inch tall ostrich plumes that allow this to be crowned, if you will, of the prominence of the person that's being carried within the hearse itself. The hearse wasn't originally built for Lincoln. It was built to have a nice hearse in the St. Louis market area, and that's how it came about to be used and requested for Lincoln. But as you walk your eyes down, there are a lot of gold continuing down to the base of the capitals that come down, and then the columns themselves are palladium leaf or silver leaf. The large lanterns that adorn each side of the front seat area are beautifully done by a local craftsman right here, the Savaggio Steel Boys here in Springfield, Illinois. And just things like that, that the wheels, when we scaled this, you counted the spokes in the rear wheels. The rear wheel had 16 spokes. Well, back in the day when you built a wheel that large, the hub had to be so large to accept the spokes. So it ended up being a 10-inch hub and a 56-inch tall diameter wheel. So this is how we scaled the rest of the hearse to come up with that. But the inside is fabulous. There's old school cloth that went into the headliner, and the velvet that's in there is just, and the tassels on the outside. It's you almost stand back in awe of this beautiful icon of freedom. We've coined this on behalf of our veterans and our president, the icon of freedom that was built for the nation.
My understanding is that this the original hearse had a history of its own prior to its use for the president's burial. Is that correct?
Yes, we've known it to be used at least three times for prominent people, all from the St. Louis area. Senator Hart Benton was one of the first to use it, we believe, and then there was a general, first general to die in the Civil War. Nathaniel, and Ian's better at history than I am, so I'll let him speak to the names. But, and then the, like an interim governor, I believe, that was actually buried back out east, but was processed through the streets of there in St. Louis. So, and then Lincoln was the fourth to be used of record that we know of, and then it was retired in 1865. Having two, we found out later, having the two silver plate medallions that were adorned with AL, his initials, in memoriam, Springfield, May 4, 1865, were found during our research, and they're both on display down at the Presidential Museum in Springfield.
And the hearse itself, the original hearse itself, is just no more, correct?
That's correct. Back in, I believe it was February of 1887, right there at the stable fire of Lynch and Arnott, it was a massive fire, and I believe if I recall correctly, there was about 200 head of horses, three human lives, and I would guess all the rest of their equipment that was unable to be salvaged. And this, I believe, was said to have been, I think, on the second floor. It must have been a multi-level building, and it was totally destroyed by fire.
All right. Well, that's the history of the original hearse. And, Ian, do you want to add something? You're a regular CSI historian, apparently. I mean, this is a lot of detective work that you've had to do to become involved in this and come up with a replica.
This was. There was only one known image taken of the hearse. We believe shortly after it was offloaded when it was shipped from St. Louis to Springfield. It was going through literally hundreds and hundreds of pages of newspapers looking for various accounts. There would be large descriptions of the events that were happening in Springfield, and then you would find a paragraph that would be dedicated to the hearse and a paragraph that would be dedicated to some other aspect of the funeral. And it was bringing all of these together with this single image. Probably the greatest excitement was when we located right here in St. Louis at the Mercantile Library on the campus of UMSL. That they had one of those two silver medallions in their collection that had actually adorned the hearse. That is probably the last major artifact from that object that was later burned up in the fire of 87. So that was very special.
I'm sure it was. Go ahead, Tim Tomlinson.
This is an apocryphal tale, the kind of tale that I like to tell to my students when I taught sophomore high school students history, that when first asked to loan the hearse to Springfield for the funeral procession, the livery owner, Mr. Arno, said, no, I won't do that. He's a Republican. Huh. And he later changed his mind and not only loaned the hearse, as we're talking about, but drove it himself in the funeral procession.
Well, politics hasn't changed much over the last 150 years, apparently. Go ahead, Ian.
This was a great opportunity. The mayor of the city of St. Louis at that time, Mayor Thompson, I believe, wanted very much for the president's body to be brought to St. Louis. He actually wrote several telegrams to Mary Lincoln imploring her, arguing that St. Louis, because it was the largest city in the West, because it was a relatively free city located within a state that had the institution of slavery, the St. Louis was kind of a microcosm of what had occurred in the nation over the 4 years, and that this would be a gift to the Western people. Unfortunately, Mary did not abide by that request. Mayor Thompson then decided that an empty casket would be placed in the courthouse downtown. Huh. Along with a bust of the president for 30 days in memoriam, and that this loaning of this very magnificent vehicle would be a way that St. Louis could certainly make its mark on this historic event.
Well, maybe we can bring the casket back at some point, Tim, and
actually
recreate that part of it.
Thank you for mentioning that. In the post-Springfield events, we're already planning a metropolitan-wide showing in October of 2015. Working with the folks in the Alton Visitor Convention Bureau and the Alton Godfrey Rotary Club. We have Lincoln Douglas Square in Alton, the site of the last of the Lincoln Douglas debates, and we see that as a wonderful venue for this possibility.
PJ, what happens to the hearse when all of this is over and done with?
Well, it will remain in the custodial care of our Staub family here in Springfield and owned by our family. However, that's my understanding that we'll be working closely with the Presidential Library Museum to have this on static display inside the museum there, probably maybe a month or two out of the year, like April, May, reminding us and remembering the assassination of our president. And I think it would be good for people to see, because there's very few images out there in history that I'm aware of, and I'm not a historian, that you can look at and you can see life, death, and a bullet for freedom taken by our president as you look at this hearse. It capsules the entire essence of why we're even, you know, he gave us a good reason to remember, and that's the freedom of our people, all people, and our African Americans as well. It's just an amazing story, an America's story, and one of the things that will be unveiled here in Springfield along with that is an original painting by Ray Simon, artist Ray Simon from Ohio, and it's going to be a spectacular America's story, he calls it, and be unveiled, and that'll be for eyes to see once again. So, and Ian may have already talked about that, I'm not sure, but I wanted to do a shout out to our friend Ray.
Well, I'm glad you did. And PJ Staub, we want to thank you so much for being with us and bringing us up to speed on the work that you've been doing with regard to the Lincoln hearse, which will be very much on display this weekend in Springfield. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us.
God bless you all. Thank you so much.
As P.J. Staub, president and co-owner of the Staub Funeral Home in Springfield, as I indicated, he is responsible in part for the replica of the funeral hearse that you'll be seeing in Springfield this weekend. I have to take another break. We'll do that and come back and continue our conversation with Ian Hunt, historian, and Tim Tomlinson, who chairs the Great Rivers Lincoln Coffin Project. Back with more and another recreator when we continue. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on weekend events in Springfield commemorating the burial of Abraham Lincoln, which was happening just 150 years ago exactly at this time. Ian Hunt is with me, historian at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum Foundation. Tim Tomlinson also in studio. He chairs the Great Rivers Lincoln Coffin Project, which along with a number of folks put together a replica of the coffin in which President Lincoln was interred. Ian, let me come back to you for just a moment in talking to PJ about the St. Louis connection and Abraham Lincoln. There really wasn't that much of a connection, was there? I mean, he didn't spend a lot of time here.
Well, I think he actually spent more time than we recognize. St. Louis was a major metropolitan center in Lincoln's early years. A lot of the goods and things of that nature that were sold in Springfield stores came out of St. Louis. They'd come up the river from New Orleans. Lincoln was a shopkeeper at the community of New Salem. We also know that the rivers were kind of the superhighways prior to the advent of the railroad and things of that nature. So we know that he was taking river trips down and visiting St. Louis. The old Camo X building in downtown St. Louis has a plaque on the wall that said that Lincoln stayed there when it was previously a hotel. I think that his visits here, because he was not yet the great emancipator, probably go missing in history.
Sure. I was going to mention that plaque because that's the only reference that I'm aware of at One Memorial Plaza to Abraham Lincoln slept here, the kind of the George Washington thing all over again.
Yeah.
How about you, Tim, and your neck of the woods, Lincoln connections?
Well, Lincoln actually had quite a bit to do with Alton, in addition to it being the site of the last of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. While it was not on the circuit that he traveled as a lawyer, it was close enough that he made several visits to the area. He was very comfortable with a family, an Edwards family in Alton, And so he was often down in the Alton area. And we suspect, for example, since the debate prior to coming to Alton was at Quincy, Illinois, he likely came down the Great Rivers in order to reach Alton in time for that seventh and last debate.
They moved around a lot in those days, those folks, even though moving around wasn't the easiest thing in the world to do. I want to get back to the recreation now because we have another interview, one that I recorded earlier with a gentleman by the name of Larry Werlein, who is a reenactor, and he's going to be heavily involved in what's going on in Springfield this weekend. There are going to be about 1,100 troops recreated in full uniform involved in the ceremonies that are taking place this weekend. And when I talked to him, the first thing I asked Larry Wehrlein was, what role are you going to be playing when all of this goes on this weekend?
Brigadier General John Cook. John was formerly the mayor of Springfield, Illinois, but enlisted and Governor Yates gave him a commission as colonel, and he went on to become a general. So at the time of Lincoln's death, John was in charge of the Illinois district, so they put him as adjutant under General Joseph Hooker, in other words, second in command of the funeral event.
What specifically was his role there? I mean, second in command, but what were his duties?
Well, the first and the main one was, where are we going to place the body? Springfield Town Fathers had decided that they wanted to place him in a certain location, but Mary Lincoln, the widow, said, no, you're going to bury him at Oak Ridge Cemetery. And it wasn't, it was a detail that actually went to the last minute before that happened. And so the other details, including parade marching order, in what order are we going to put the prominent civilians, and where the carriages would go, and where the soldiers would go, and how many civilians were allowed, and would the colored population of Springfield be allowed to attend as well? Those were a number of issues that had to be ironed out in just a short amount of time. One thing I should note, this was Lincoln's 13th and final funeral. So in each stop along the way, and the train route took 20 days, they performed a funeral and a procession and so forth without the burial portion of it. And so every town, as they came through, it was like Harrisburg and Baltimore and Albany and New York and Philadelphia, Buffalo, Columbus, Cleveland, Chicago, Indianapolis, and of course Springfield, each one would send representatives to the previous funeral to check out what they were doing, so to make sure that when their funeral came along, it would be even better. Lincoln probably had the grandest funeral of all times, probably better than any pharaoh or emperor or king along the way.
How attentive can you be at this point, you and your fellow reenactors, to historical detail as to what went on and how you're going to perform over the weekend?
We did extensive research of the period, so we know who was there, the marching order, how the soldiers carried their weapons, where their armbands were placed, the black armbands and the ribbons, the mourning ribbons, and so forth. So we've done pretty well in that regard of attempting to recreate a period of time that was quite mournful for the nation. And this is the first time we know that this has ever been reenacted.
Who are the reenactors?
Primarily reenactors, mostly from the Midwest. We have a lot of registrations from Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio. But then there's several other states that are represented as well.
And that's an awful lot of vintage uniforms and vintage equipment to bring together. I guess the reenactors have all that personally, though, don't they?
That is correct. That's part of their investment in the hobby, is to get authentic uniforms. We don't want any non-authentic uniforms in or civilian impressions as well. We're trying to be as period-friendly as we can.
This is a pretty big deal for them, isn't it?
If you're a Lincoln aficionado, this is the tops. You know, this is where Lincoln was, where he lived, and where he worked, and where he's buried. And so the town of Springfield is full of Lincoln sites, and it's like a pilgrimage for reenactors who want to come and pay homage to their great leader. And it's a way of expressing that.
Well, I'm sure you're looking forward to it, Larry Wehrlein.
Oh, definitely. This is I'm a Lincoln fan as well, so all things Lincoln are important to me.
That's reenactor Larry Werlein, who will be portraying General John Cook at ceremonies this weekend, recreating and commemorating the burial of Abraham Lincoln. Ian Hunt, let me come back to you with regard to the fact that there were so many troops going to be involved this weekend, but so many troops were involved during the original event itself. Were these troops there for ceremonial purposes or for security purposes? Because the country was so fragile at that time.
The events that occurred in Washington, most of the troops that were on hand were there for the defense of the city, absolutely. As the train makes its way west, the soldiers now are more transitioning into a role in which they're paying homage to the president. They're wanting to give him the same honor and dignity that he had shown them in any of the famous orations that he gave during the course of the war. So I think that the fear of subversion or something of that nature really kind of dwindles away. But absolutely, the troops in Washington had been defending that city for 4 years, mm-hmm. and they certainly would have been ready had any kind of attack or mischief tried to occur.
Yeah. Tim, go ahead, Tim.
As the train moved westward, actually thousands of civilians also joined the various processions in the various cities. And they marched in occupations often as newspapermen, as painters, as lawyers, as professionals of other different kinds. I'm going to be one of the 1,100 official reenactors.
Oh, you really?
Yes, I am. My persona will be that of Dr. Benjamin St. James Fry, who in 1865 had only 1 year been mustered out from the 63rd Ohio Volunteer Infantry, where he was a chaplain. He came to St. Louis in 1865 and would become the editor of the Methodist weekly newspaper for over 20 years. He founded our Chautauqua in 1885, 20 years after the Civil War, and also the Compton Heights neighborhood in South St. Louis. So I don't know that Fry was there. I have a copy of a letter that Fry wrote Lincoln in 1864, but he could have been there. And I think if he had a chance to be there, he would have been there. Yeah.
Only a few seconds left. What motivates you to get so heavily involved in Lincoln memorabilia, if you will?
Well, the challenge of the project. I have a background in history, but this is not my field. And I don't count myself as a Lincoln scholar, but I have really enjoyed this project.
And Ian Hunt, just a few seconds left. What do you think it is about Lincoln that inspires people the way that he does, even to this day?
His eloquence, his humanity, his bravery, his forward thinking. All of these things come together and they create a truly unique individual.
It'll really be interesting to see how many people show up in Springfield this weekend. I think it's many, many thousands, obviously. There's such great interest in this man and this time. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Ian Hunt, thank you so much
for
spending time. Tim Tomlinson, it's been great meeting you. Have a lot of fun this weekend. Thank you so much, sir. That's it for us. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the bioengineering design and entrepreneurship incubator Idea Labs, in which Washington University engineering and medical students work on unmet needs in healthcare, seeking an entrepreneurial solution. Then we'll take a look at the role of independent bookstores in our community. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. And we say goodbye to music of the era about which we've been talking for the past hour. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.